collected 5 different life forms from the darkest corners of the universe. Monsters.
Collision imminent.
Invasive species. Predatory. If we don't lock them down, it will be too late.
Beware, spoiler phobes! You have stumbled into A Storm of Spoilers, a podcast currently covering the FX on Hulu series Alien Earth. For our final episode this season, the wrap-up episode, we will, perhaps predictably, be looking at the entire 8-episode season of television as a whole. We will read some of your emails, give our closing thoughts, recognize some superlatives, and discuss just what the series accomplished as a television show. Then, after ample warning, we will jump into this week's storm section, which is more of a storm of speculation around what we might see in season 2, and if there's gonna be a predator in it, because why give up a good bit 9 episodes in? Why, hello! I'm Dave Gonzalez, and it looks like I'll be protecting the omelet for a couple of years at least.
And I'm Neil Miller, and I'm gonna hide and follow until another season comes along, or at least gets green lit. And welcome back to A Storm of Spoilers. Before we get started, some housekeeping. You may be wondering, if you're just jumping in, which is weird, why are you jumping in at the end? What happens next for A Storm of Spoilers? Well, I will tell you, dear listener. Next week, we are off. That is the week of 10-5. Enjoy the week without us, I guess. I don't know. The following week.
It's October 5th for our international listeners. That could be the week of 5-10, right?
Yeah, sorry. October 5th, the week of October 5th. So the week of October 12th, we will return to begin the windup for Welcome to Derry, which does not premiere until the end of the month, but we are going to spend the 2 weeks before that digging into It Part 1 and It. Are they chapters? Chapter 2?
They are. It is chapter 1. That's and right. Chapter 2
chapter
now.
One and chapter 2. That's right. So we're going to do those in consecutive weeks. And then at the end, the final week of the month, right before Halloween, we are going to begin watching the HBO Max, the HBO series. Sorry. Welcome to Derry, which is going to be very fun, very interesting. Dave's reading a whole big audiobook for it. It's going to be great. We're going to be doing all kinds of adaptation corners. You can also get this podcast, Storm of Spoilers, the Alien Earth edition, on YouTube, youtube.com/@DaveandNeil, DaveandNeil. If you would like to see the facial expressions that I'm making while I'm reading off of our notes set doc here, it's pretty great. If you'd like more from Dave and I, you can join us over at patreon.com/DaveandNeil, spelled the same way, for more content related to things that you hear in this feed, but also all kinds of fun other stuff, including our Twin Peaks rewatch project, a Leftovers rewatch project. Currently, we're doing a Hannibal rewatch project, which is very fun. We also do a weekly adventure pod. This month, we're going to be diving into movies that are, about Ed Gein. And that's going to be very fun. Those come out on Friday. And most importantly, you get access to our Slack community, which is just the most wonderful place to be online, which is a horrible place to be in general. So, you know, join the Slack. It's pretty great. Okay, that's all the housekeeping I have for you this week. Moving on to how you can get in touch with this show. You know you have this next week off. If you'd like to send us ravens, a storm of spoilers @gmail.com and tell us what you think of Stephen King's It, or if you want to say more things about Alien Earth, we'll listen to those as well. We'll read them all. You can also review us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Leave us a 5-star rating. Say whatever it is you want. We actually got an email about a review, which is pretty great. And I want to thank John from Victoria, Australia, who sent a screenshot of his review, because I don't have the ability to look at Australian Apple Podcasts. So I missed this one. And by screenshotting it and sending it to us, John made sure that we saw it. And here was his review. It says, I've been looking for a follow-along pod for the new Alien series after the first ep. Gave this a try and have been hooked. You are in my weekly rotation of listens and look forward to both the rest of the series and whatever you turn your eye 2 in the future. Thanks, John in Australia. I love this because it's a new listener. I love new listeners. It's not someone who's like, I'm still listening to you guys, even though Joanna's not there.
Yeah, I miss Joanna Robinson. And like, maybe you guys can watch Lost a third time. But yeah, this is fantastic.
We love all of our, listeners who've been with us a long time. But welcome, John, to the party. I hope you're ready to talk about it in a couple of weeks. That will be fun. So if you would like to join John, make sure you jump onto Apple Podcasts or Spotify and leave us a rating and review. That's very helpful. All right, calm time. I've got some Ravens, Dave. Some interesting stuff to talk about. The first one comes from Colin. This is a long one, but it cues up a interesting theory, I think. Colin says, listen to the finale episode, and some comments you guys had made got me thinking. The fact that there's still a couple more Xeno eggs left in the lab, and Marcy/Wendy seems to want the Xenomorphs to be free and do their own thing. Quote, they didn't ask to be brought here. We also know that Yutani is on the way to Neverland to ostensibly take control back of the alien species, and Weyland-Yutani, as a corporation going forward, has an obsession with getting a hold of the Xenomorphs. Forgive me if I'm missing or forgetting any specific details or counter-evidence. It's been too long since I watched any of the films in the Alien franchise, but is there any way in which Wendy and the Lost Boys somehow gain control of or influence over Weyland-Yutani Corporation going forward into the movie timeline, and the obsession over the corporate Xenomorphs isn't about weaponizing them like we've always thought/assumed, but instead trying to consolidate them and help them flourish? Wendy is clearly sympathetic to the Xenomorphs and considers herself to be on their side. I'm wildly speculating that the hybrids find a way to replace Yutani somehow, maybe with a hybrid replacement body swap or something along those lines, or maybe just deceive/make a deal with Yutani to convince her to collect Xenomorphs. However they do it, that's when Weyland-Yutani starts to really lean into the Xenomorph obsession, or at least more so than it already was. Lost Boys use Weyland-Yutani's resources to set in motion plans to get more Xenomorphs brought back to Earth to eventually replace humans, because humans suck, all under the guise of wanting to weaponize the Xenomorphs for profit. End of Raven. This, I think, is kind of a fun one. I don't know if I necessarily want to go all the way here with Colin's theory, but I do.
The swap and replace?
Like the swap and replace of Yutani. But I do think it's interesting. I mean, this is one of the open-ended threads that the season has left us with, which is the fact that Yutani is like literally in transit, or at least her people are in transit on their way to Neverland. So in a theoretical season 2, this would kind of be like one of the first things you'd have to deal with, which is what happens when they get to the island. And is there a negotiation of some kind between Wendy and Yutani? And like how, I guess the big question for me is how would Yutani react if she found out that Wendy could talk to the Xenomorphs?
I mean, I'm of two minds about this. One, I think Yutani figuring out that Wendy can talk to the Xenomorphs again. I think I said this at some point when Wendy started talking to the Xenomorphs on the podcast, is that makes a little bit more sense to me why anybody in this universe thought they could control the alien. Mm-hmm. Because the idea that like it could be an interesting company asset is only interesting if you could do something with it. And all the other alien properties, it's like it's impossible to get them back. You can't really seem to control them. If you take it as far as like Resurrection, which I know is post Weyland-Yutani, it's another corporation or military, whatever it is, floating cloning lab. Like all of them think they could control the alien, and which seemed weird to me for a certain period of time, because it seems like all of these stories are you can't control the alien. Now we have one where you can, in theory, control the alien. So if Yutani sees it, then I'm a little bit more inclined to think they aren't being idiots when they send the Nostromo out to like go pick one up and bring one back. And the thing that I like about Colin's idea, no matter how I think unlikely this specific iteration might be, is it would be very interesting to sort of flip what we thought Weyland-Yutani wanted, because we know what they want from like Mother and Ash, that like all these people are expendable to get the alien back. And then obviously what Burke does in Aliens makes it look like they're willing to sacrifice an entire terraforming colony and a bunch of colonial marines just to get the alien back. But then when we, you know, they show up at the end of Alien 3, they're basically there to like rescue Ripley from the prison planet. And Ripley's so convinced that they want the alien. But we never actually hear the Weyland-Yutani guy say that. Mm-hmm. So there is room in this story universe to redefine what Weyland-Yutani actually wanted. So even though I don't think necessarily they're going to, or Wendy, Marcy, the new emerged being, is going to become in control of all of Yutani and use that to like reach out and find more xenomorphs, I do think there's room for this series to change what Weyland-Yutani wants to get a xenomorph for, without necessarily going against the basic corporate greed themes of the franchise.
Yeah. And I definitely see a plausible path for like Wendy being able to avoid conflict with Yutani, right? Mm-hmm. Being able to maybe trade some eggs for Yutani, allowing her to like keep her two existing xenomorphs that she already has, kind of deal. And Yutani like maybe even allowing Wendy to take the Lost Boys off planet, right? It, like, hey, I'll take my two growing xenomorphs. You put us on a spaceship and we'll leave. You can have the eggs. And now you know that I guess it's possible to be able to communicate with the xenomorphs. So, you know, good luck with that. And I definitely think that like it puts Wendy in a good negotiating position when she finally has to come up against Yutani, right? Now that she's
in
control of Neverland Island. So I like this. I think that this is one of the questions I would love for a season two to be interested in, but we'll see. Mm-hmm.
Still no official pickup. Yes. Since we don't have a place to put it on the podcast as of this recording.
As of October 1st.
First day of October.
Yep. All right. Second Raven, which is also brings up a question that I absolutely think season two is going to have to answer. This one comes from Don. Don says, I've been a sci-fi fan since the day Star Wars hit screens in 1977. I'm like, way to date yourself there, Don. And as such, I am quite skilled in the art of suspended disbelief. Spaceships, great. Xenomorphs, fantastic. Eyeball octopus that can attach to the brain and control a living creature. Absolutely. Love it. Said eyeball octopus reanimating a dead body. Nope, nope, nope. Cells need energy to function. You need operational, circulatory, and respiratory systems for that. Once the chest burster did its work and those systems are gone from Arthur, surely I can't be the only one to bump up against this question mark. Good question there, Don. I guess I would disagree with the underlying premise here that you need a circulatory function. Because I just watched Marvel Zombies and I was reminded that zombies exist. So maybe that's the simple answer, which is like the Ms. Octo has zombifying power in some way. But I do think that this is going to be a very good question for the sort of Arthur character. Now that the eye is in Arthur, not only how is it functioning, but what are the limits of its functionality? Will it be able to talk to Boyd Cavalier?
It has some sort of capability to make those things function. Because, like, I don't think that cat was still alive by the time we caught up with it in, like, episode two.
And I don't think, like, Schmel would be alive after the eye sucked its eyeball out and burrowed into its brain.
The ultimate question is, the show allowed us to sort of suspend our disbelief at the point that it could kill something by removing its eye and replacing its eye and then sort of like take over its body. Like, the killing's implied there, which does mean, I think, somewhere it has to, in one of its little tentacles when it attaches to the brain or the circulatory system, I assume it's like creating some sort of electricity that makes the brain think it's functioning. Like, I assume it's passively inflating the lungs like a face hugger, or making the heart beat just to get things to move. I think it's like, you know, what do I need to do to get to animate this flesh? I also initially had a little kick when it did that to Arthur, just because I had no idea it was that powerful.
Sure.
Because
especially because Arthur had been dead for a while at this point.
Right. So, like, he had passed electrical brain death. So, like, people who were assuming that it sort of, like, was capable of absorbing brain activity, if that is one of its powers, it was not able to do that to Arthur. Arthur would be, like, brain dead. But I don't think he would have rotted enough that all those, like, you know, circuitry wouldn't have worked. His main deficiency there is one of his lungs isn't going to work like the rest of his lungs. Sure. Like, he has a big hole in his chest. So that's more where the... Yeah, you know, the disbelief comes in. But that being said, just because the lungs aren't filling with air through the throat, the lungs are technically open. So, like, if you get the alveoli to work, do you even need to breathe? That's more of like a zombie question. It's like, what level of control does he have over the body? If Arthur shows up and he's able to, like, sew up his chest and whatever, then yes, I believe we're in, like, a weird sci-fi thing that, like, is slightly beyond. But I do believe that, given what we've seen the eyeball take over so far, it is able to sort of, like, at least for a little while, jumpstart a heavily damaged body. Sure. So I get where Don's coming from, because that was my initial reaction, but the more I thought about it, the more I was okay with it, given what we've seen the eye do.
I am also curious, and this isn't something we'll be able to know until the eye can talk, which is how much of a conversation is happening back and forth between the eye and the brain of the thing that it's in. Which is, like, let's say he is Ms. Octo is able to reanimate and reboot Arthur's systems, right? And put electrical impulses back into Arthur's brain. His brain isn't, like, rotted. It's dead, but it's not rotted away. So then the question becomes, like, how much of Arthur's memories and information could be recovered, essentially, from that brain, which I think would be very interesting, right, for the eye as a little scamp who causes trouble, to have Arthur's knowledge, or at least pieces of Arthur's knowledge, going back toward the facility, right? Like, that makes it even more dangerous to know, like, passcodes and shit, and to know, like, the hybrids in and out, because Arthur's one of the ones who created them. So I think that could that be would really feel, fascinating.
That would feel overpowered to me, but you know what? Where we end Wendy in season one feels overpowered to me. So it's a show of power creep.
Yeah,
I mean, that could go in that direction.
This is an alien life form that has survived in an ecosystem that is either alongside or near a xenomorph, and has evolved alongside a xenomorph. So I guess I raise the ceiling for its potential based on that, which is, like, you know, all of these things sort of lived in the same solar system at the very least as something as dangerous as a xenomorph. And I think that we can safely assume that they are all more powerful than any human.
This leads me to my first looking at the series in overview question, which is before Alien Earth started, Noah Hawley was giving interviews about what sort of drew him to this project and how it was going to go. And he said one of the things that allowed him to crack it was sort of like this goal of wanting to remystify the alien universe, that maybe the aliens versus predators of it all had sort of made the aliens not super scary, or the world of Alien not super scary beyond the xenomorph even. Do you think that they succeeded in this first season of television? Do you feel more interested or less interested than the alien universe, say, after something like Alien Romulus, which we had recently?
I think so. I mean, I think just from a standpoint of world building and building out, being able to sort of use Earth as your starting point and ask the question, like, what is going on Earth all this time while, you know, the Nostromo is floating out there in space headed toward a xenomorph? And what is going on Earth that will lead the Weyland-Yutani Corporation to have this desire to gather these species? And I think being able to show us that desire was there a lot earlier than maybe we had initially thought is great. But I also think that they've used it in a smart way. They've used this opportunity to build out what the future of humanity is like in this world, And I think that that's raised some really cool and fun, interesting questions about, like we've talked about throughout this podcast during the season, of like, what is education like? What is religion like for these people? What is life under this like hyper-capitalist corporate governance like for people? And, you know, where does a power like the Xenomorph even fit into that grand design? And I think that from that standpoint, just adding that to the story world has done enough to sort of reinvigorate and re-mystify the Alien franchise. And, you know, I mean, it also, I was thinking about this as I was rewatching it over the weekend. It just did what I wanted from an Alien franchise, right? Like it gave me some really cool Xenomorph stuff. There's some new creatures that are really fascinating and interesting, right? The Eye is like a star. Mm-hmm. And it had more on its mind than just what if Xenomorph on Earth, right?
Right.
It had a lot of on its mind about, again, hyper-capitalism, but also human evolution and whether or not hybridization is even possible, right? We had a number of conversations about the human soul and whether that can even be transferred into a synthetic body. So I think that, yeah, it is invigorated a discussion in a way that I very much enjoyed and wanted. I guess my main criticism is that I wanted more, which is,
yes, you know,
it happens.
I mean, I can agree with that. I also want to self-correct here because I could feel the Spotify comments. Also, Noah Hawley could have been saying remystifying because he thought like Prometheus and Covenant were maybe a little bit over-explaining in terms of like why the Xenomorph and sure, maybe not as focused on what they were trying to do elsewise. And I do think he managed to, in introducing the hybrids to this universe, sort of reclaim that idea that had maybe gotten stale, the idea of the synth, the thing that was sort of moving the alien franchise closer to the Blade Runner franchise and not and further away from like a horror or action franchise like the first two films were. So I could see it also doing that. I think it definitely remystified the universe. And again, I'm probably just saying what you were saying in like a little bit of shorter time, but it was capable of opening up another corner of it that I think didn't necessarily break the canon of the previous things. I think it has the potential to break the canon of the previous things because I could also imagine people disagree with me where they're like, they made the Xenomorph a pet. How are you ever going to like roll that back? How is that demystifying?
Sure. But only for Wendy.
Only for Wendy, as far as we know.
And I kind of like, you know, I was a little skeptical before this season started when Noah Hawley was saying stuff about like not really being as interested in the lore from Prometheus and Covenant and like the David of it all. Mm-hmm. And I think I understand that better now. It's not that he was like looking down on that or didn't think that was interesting. It's just that he's telling a similar story about synthetic life forms, but that is less interested in humanity's origins, which is what Prometheus and Covenant are doing, and more interested in humanity's future in this story world and how humanity. And I think that is honestly a much more relevant topic to hit in an Alien show now than it would have been in even say 2013, because we're much further down the line of like, the AI bubble and whatnot, and thinking about, you know, are we ever going to be able to create something like this that's smarter than us, and will we ultimately be replaced? And I think that, yeah, I think he threaded the needle really well to the extent that I think it, I agree with you. It doesn't break any of the canon in any direction, but it also does open up a lot of avenues for them to continue to expand the world. And I, you know, it's a world that I will keep coming back to.
Yeah. I mean, speaking of, Sigourney Weaver in an interview said that she thinks Alien Earth is much more profound than an alien movie, which I think is interesting.
Sure.
Because Sigourney Weaver,
coming from the queen herself.
Yeah, she keeps it. Every behind the scenes stories, every story I've heard from Aliens and Alien 3 and Alien Resurrection is Sigourney Weaver basically being like, I would like for Ripley to do something, please. And then they change the script to make her happy. And she's like, okay, cool, I'll come back. So I on one hand, I think that's a fantastic compliment to get from Sigourney Weaver. On the other hand, Neil, I think some Alien movies have had some of these things on their mind.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't think that I agree with her. I do agree that this is more profound, but I think it's because of the format, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's an 8-episode television series, it has more room to slow down, be more character focused, again, be more focused on the world and the culture of what's happening on Earth, which I think is profoundly interesting at the very least. And rather than be like a, you know, a tight horror story, which is what most Alien movies have to be. And so I think that she's not wrong. It is a much more profound experience than an Alien movie, but it's more because that's what it's intended to be.
Right.
Right. Like that's what a TV show, that's what an 8-episode television series is going to be compared to a 2-hour movie. And I think that what it says to me is that the Alien franchise, like many great franchises, can exist in both spaces, right? We can have a good, fast-paced, self-contained movie like Romulus come out and be a good addition to the franchise. And we could spend a lot more time on something like Alien Earth. So I think that maybe what Sigourney Weaver is getting at is we should make more Alien TV shows.
I mean, that would
not be just the season 2 of this, but maybe more from elsewhere in the universe. Because again, and I think I mentioned this as we've been going along, I really like how the franchise is being just like, we just sort of dip in at different points on the timeline. Mm-hmm. And we're not necessarily following a single story that's like building up to something, right? Like the Alien franchise isn't building towards its Avengers Endgame. It's just sort of like poking into different points on the timeline to slowly but surely give us a better picture of what's going on in this universe across hundreds and hundreds of years. And I think that's actually a really cool and preferable way to do it than try to like tell a coherent story that goes like, if they were going to try to connect Covenant all the way to like Resurrection, I wouldn't try to do that in one shot, you know?
Right. Exactly. That's a big ask. Speaking about making it all connect, I have a bigger question, that I've been thinking about in regards to Alien Earth and the various responses to it. I think, a lot of people like it. Those are obviously the corners of the internet that I'm in. I think those mm-hmm. are interesting corners of the internet. But I also have seen some people that, you know, have some criticisms that I think are valid. I think
they're nitpicking on the Reddit, Dave? Is that what you're saying?
I mean, sometimes they're nitpicking on the Reddit. Other times it's just like a good criticism. So I will give the example of one post that had how did she die, and it has a picture of, I believe, Sullivan, which is the Maginot crew member that was being creeped on by the android Temu, I believe his name was. Temu is the shop. Tang the Temu Ash, who wasn't an android at all. Tang, who was creeping very human-like on Sullivan. We see her in episode 2 with some sort of wound in the side of her body in the cryopod. It seems kind of low for a chest burster. And you and I called this out in our episode 2 podcast in terms of like trying to keep track of how people died. But she is not in the In Space No One episode dying in that sort of way. So somebody is like, it appears she got killed by a chest burster. However, there's absolutely no clue, no reason for it to come. So what happened to her? Did the showrunner forget about her? And of course, we get some of the, Danny just sort of forgot about meme. That's a great reaction because classic. That's actually kind of true. When we talked about In Space No One, I talked about how Noah Hawley wrote the pilot episodes first and then went back and had to construct, you know, the episode. So it's possible she ended up on the cutting room floor. It's possible that she was a creepy thing to find in the episode two script, but just there wasn't time for it narratively. Mm-hmm. And then there's a group of fandom that are like, well, obviously this is a tick, or this is something else that just managed to be in the Maginot, or, you know, this was something that was like inside of her when the ship crashed and, you know, did some sort of like acid melt to get outside of her in a panic. And I was like, these are the two different types of fandom. And I first encountered this in like early 90s, like Star Wars fandom, because we weren't getting any more Star Wars. So we just had to endlessly debate the other stuff that we got. Do you prefer a fandom that very accurately judges something for how it is? And it's like, you know, if I see it on screen, it's text in the canon, and otherwise it's like, you know, a potential for more story or at best, or a plot hole at worst? Or do you like the type of fandom where it's like, well, this happened, what do I know from my crazy fandom brain that could make this a valuable like thing? Even though I think sometimes that wild fandom is what gets you and I overpsyched for some mm-hmm. types of, you know, different entries and different types of franchises.
Sure.
We're like, oh my God, it could be this. We might be running smack dab into a it clothesline with this exact thing. We're like, oh my God, it could be all these cool things. And it's just going to end up being something much, much more generic. So do you like your fandom like just loving that property, but willing to only like cleave to the text? Or are you a fan of the, you know, crazy agnostic priests out there in the wilderness screaming about the life cycle of the xenomorph?
Here's the thing, Dave. Give me a fandom that can do both.
Yeah.
That's what I prefer. I mean, because I do think that going into it with the understanding that this is a production and that, you know, things happen and that there are occasionally just holes, you know, in the way things are written, especially when you're doing something this complicated inside of a world that's already fairly complicated. Mm-hmm. Sometimes things just get lost in the shuffle. I mean, it's not always, you know, forgetting about the fleet like Daenerys did. I mean, that's a big one. But this one could just, again, just be like a visual thing that they set up that they just never got around to paying off. But I also love a good theory, right? I love taking something and being like, all right, well, what if this, what actually did happen here, like in the story world? It's just, you don't want those theories, as I've said many times, to become your expectation, right? I love the idea of going down this road of like, what was the deal with Sullivan? How did she die? Why was Tang hovering over her? Why was everyone aware of it? Like, I have a list of questions about Sullivan. But if they never get answered, that doesn't mean this is a bad show.
Right.
Right. Like, if Noah Hawley genuinely and the writer's room genuinely just forgot about her and moved on and or have moved on to a completely different story, and I'm enjoying that story, that's still a good show. So I'm not going to like take points off for it. That said, I think that this is always a question that they can come back to, right? Like this was a question that we had right after the In Space No One episode, which was like, are we going to come back to more flashbacks of the Maginot? Like, I remember mm-hmm. asking that because there were a bunch of questions that felt left kind of open from the Maginot. So I don't know if we're necessarily done, or we don't necessarily have to be done with the Maginot, is what I'm saying. It's like, right, we could come back in a season two and do a couple of more flashbacks that become relevant. Again, we also think, you and I think, are pretty much aligned in thinking that there is a tick outbreak in New Siam that is going to devastate the city center. So like, but like the show didn't have any interest in that. So, but again, still out there. Still could be there for season two. The show was not subtle about showing us that there were many, many, many more ticks than what ended up on Neverland Island. So I like a fandom that can do both, because the first part allows you to be more grounded and, you know, keep your expectations in check before you get to the wild theory stuff. The wild theory stuff is just for funsies.
Yeah. I will also say I let free my corral on wild theories if the show gets canceled. Then it's like, all right.
Oh, yeah.
But then it's open then season until someone comes along and fixes this mess.
Yeah. Especially in the Alien franchise, knowing how Ridley Scott feels about all of this, which is who the fuck cares about continuity.
I mean, so. I'm surprised no one's come back around to do a straight up action movie in a while, but maybe that's because there are such excellent representations of that in the video game world.
Sure. You know? That's true. Well, and I also wouldn't be entirely surprised if, let's say, they find a hot new director to do the Alien Romulus sequel, and it has zero references to anything that happened in Alien Earth.
It's like, back to the Colonial Marines.
Yep. And it never at any point do we even get like a whiff of Alien Earth related stuff. Like, not even a mention of the Prodigy Corporation. That would not surprise me, because that's also sort of the way this franchise is being shepherded by a very cranky, brilliant old British man.
Very cranky old British man, and brilliant. Yes, absolutely. We are going to give some awards to our favorite stuff in season one of Alien Earth right after this. This episode of Storm of Spoilers is sponsored by Alien Rogue Incursion Evolved Edition, made for Alien fans, built for action horror, re-envisioned for PlayStation 5, Xbox Series X and S, and PC.
Step into the boots of rogue Colonial Marine Zula Hendrix in the terrifying first chapter of a two-part saga set between the Alien and Aliens films. Sent to investigate a distress call on the remote planet Perdan, Zula uncovers a secret Weyland-Yutani black site overrun by xenomorphs. These aren't just any xenomorphs. They're the smartest and most cunning ever portrayed in a game. They stalk, they hunt, and they strike with the same terrifying unpredictability as in the movies. With your synth companion Davis-01 at your side, you fight to survive using weapons, skills, and sheer determination in this gripping original story.
Alien Rogue Incursion Evolved Edition has been rebuilt with stunning visuals, 60 FPS performance, 3D audio, haptic feedback, and adaptive triggers, delivering a cinematic action horror experience that makes you feel like you're truly inside the world of Alien. Coming September 30th, 2025, to PC and consoles, Alien Rogue Incursion Evolved Edition. And we're back. We have some superlatives that Neil has picked for season one of Alien Earth. And I really missed Trial by Content, a show Neil and I did with Joanna Robinson over on the Ringer Network this week, because I was like, oh, yes, I would like to like narrow all of these things down. So my list has multiple entries, but Neil, it seems like followed the assignment. So I'm going to let Neil go first, and then we'll decide together how right you are, I think, is going to be the way to do this.
Okay.
So, Neil, who's your on-screen season MVP? This is an actor, somebody who definitely is above the line, as we would say.
Well, listen, I think it's time, and, you know, this is always tough for me because I'm notoriously an anti-Nepo baby person. But it's time to induct another Nepo baby into the upper atmosphere, the Hall of Fame. Sydney Chandler, excellent performance, I think. And I really honestly think all of the hybrid actors are really good, because it's a very tough assignment, acting like you are a 12-year-old in an adult body, despite the fact that you, the actor, are the adult whose body is being used in this experiment. But I think she really pulls it off. I think Wendy is a really fully realized character. She's got a very good range to her of different emotions. And I think that there are times when the little kid comes out that I think are very interesting. And then she also hits the right tone for when Wendy needs to be like frighteningly advanced,
yeah,
in comparison to the humans around her. And I think that's it's not an easy task, and I think she pulls it off really well. Shout out to Coach Taylor's daughter.
Shout out to Coach Taylor's daughter. Sydney Chandler is also on my several person list, but nice. At the top I have a tie.
Oh, okay.
between Samuel Blanken, Cavalier, and Babu Cisse, Morrow, because I think those are the two performances that really grew and surprised me as the season went on. The sort of revelation in the final episode that Kid Cavalier can't be scared, like he's going to be thrilled. When our bodies give off the scared emotion, he gives off like some sort of thrilled emotion.
It's genuine psychopath shit.
Was like a fantastic way also of just reinterpreting all the stuff that I'd been assuming about him anyway. But like, instead of being like, how could this guy be so stupid? Is he like Elon Musk in the first two episodes sending his $1 billion kids to like an alien crash site? We later learn that he caused it. And he's like, he's beyond Elon Musk and just like his weird insanity, and he had killed his dad. So I like the arc of that. And then Babu Cisse's sort of arc, especially how it grows and in Space No One suddenly, where I'm like sort of wary of him because he's obviously the Yutani person who lets his crew die at the beginning when we first meet him, but then slowly coming to an understanding of that. And if not a full understanding and appreciation to his purity of vision of, you know, just being about the mission now that his life is owned by Yutani, is, I think, really, really interesting. And I think both of those portrayals had more layers than I gave them credit for. So I really enjoy
for
them.
Sure. Yeah, I also had Samuel Blanken on my... This is one of the ones where I had multiples, but Samuel Blanken,
yeah,
really great. Only let his accent slip once, which is fine. And the other one I had on my list was Timmy Oliphant.
Yeah,
Oliphant. He's just having fun. I think, another sort of core element of the Alien franchise that you need is a really good android. And, you know, casting Timothy Oliphant was a slam dunk for this show for their android character, because, you know, he's like, you just never know what side Kirsch is on, which is pretty great. Like Kirsch, I think Kirsch ultimately is just on the side of science. Like he just wants science to happen at all times.
Somebody needs to be on the side of science.
Yeah. What happened to Isaac? Science.
All right. So that being said, who's your below the line season MVP? So the behind the scenes person making stuff happen.
Well, this was tough because, you know, as prestige TV shows go, this one is very well crafted. So I feel like you could choose a number of departments. But in my rewatch, I sat down and watched it with headphones on, and I realized that the sound design in this show is sick, and sick in a good way. So I'm going to give it to Lee Gilmore, Nolan McNaughton, Brad North, and team, the sound designer. Lee Gilmore is the supervising sound editor / sound designer. Nolan McNaughton is the sound effects editor, and Brad North is the supervising sound editor. The sound design on this show is awesome. Lots of squelches and squishes and very subtle sound effects that I think, you know, help set the mood, but also as much as the visual effects play a huge role in bringing the five different creatures that we encounter to life, the sound effects are massive in that arena, right? The sound that the xenomorph makes, the sound, even some of the sounds that like the petal monster makes when it's just like sitting there, are very, very disconcerting. And I just think that is, again, another pillar of the Alien franchise is the atmosphere, and the sound design does quite a lot of heavy lifting toward creating that atmosphere, and they did a great job.
I love it. Sound was also on my list, but not at the top. I am actually going to give it to Connie Parker, the makeup department head.
Ooh.
Because I think a 1979 future is such a like thin razor wire to walk without it feeling stupid in one way or the other. Mm-hmm. And I think bearded scientists, I think those haircuts on the children, I think was all pretty incredible. And this isn't the special effects makeup. This is just how people look to not take you out of the world when horror things aren't happening to them.
Especially like the Maginot crew. Like their entire aesthetic matches what we eventually would, like if you went from watching like In Space No One, episode 5 of this series, and then immediately flipped on 1979's Alien, those people all live in the same universe around the same time. And it's great. I think that's a key detail.
Because the story narrows down during the first season, I had sort of forgotten until I went back and rewatched certain things, how like big the first two episodes are in terms of telling us how other people live just by how they look. Scenes like the Ice Age 4 sequence where she's watching it and we see like other people watching it and we see Joe watching it in his like tenement house. Just like, I think some really well done makeup on these people to make them look like they're not in 2025, but also keep the pixie cut on Sydney Chandler, because otherwise I wouldn't be able to recognize her. And then my runner up was Lee Stringer. He's the onset VFX supervisor, which is the person who's going to make sure that everything lines up for the extensions, for the only time he dropped the ball with some digital dust, but so falls some of the best VFX supervisors ever. So
it's true.
Lee Stringer, great job. speaking of visual effects, what, Neil, did you think was the best visual effect? So this could be computer-generated images, or it could be a special effect, a practical effect. What was the standout of season one for you?
Well, I think this one was mostly digital, almost entirely digital, and not necessarily perfect. I do think that there was, especially in the finale, some issues with weight and how much this thing weighed and how that translated. But I will say that the eye, the Oculus, Ms. Octo, as she's known to her friends, it's a cool design. And I think they pulled it off extremely well in the way that it looks, not only when it's like inside the body of like the sheep, for instance, but also when it's just like running around on its own, like the effect of like the eye. What do they call that? The iris
splitting
apart into multiple pieces. Also the reverse effect of where we get like the POV vision is really cool. I just think like top to bottom, the design of the eye is awesome and it looks great. You know, Sydney Chandler kicking it around in the finale is a little goofy, but not that goofy. Like, it worked better than you would expect, especially on a TV budget. So yeah, I think the eye is awesome.
Hell yeah. The eye was also up there for me, so I'll take my second pick. I'm going to take the sequence that is the dissection of the egg and face hugger. That I think is just some great mix of both. It's a lot of practical. It's some pneumatic puppets. It's some old-fashioned oyster-looking guts. There's a transparent level inside the egg that we sort of get to look at for a little bit, and then finally we get to pull out the little embryo that is completely digital. And I really like that sequence. I really like taking it old school and then adding a little flake of new lore on top.
Very goopy.
And then from what I could tell, like 90% practical.
Yep.
So it's pretty great. All right, Neil, the big one, the best episode of the 8 episodes we got of Alien Earth season 1.
I think they're all pretty good, but you can tell that there was just a little extra put into episode 5, In Space, No One, because it's an alien movie inside of a TV show. And I think that, you know, that like you, as you're watching that episode, you can feel like this is maybe the reason why Noah Hawley wanted to make this show so that he could direct this episode. Right. Cause it's like, and I don't know if he has designs on making his own alien movie at some point, but like, if they're not going to let you make an alien movie, then get him to let you make an alien TV show. And then inside of that, make your own alien movie. And he really, I think, pulls it off really well. I also like the positioning of this episode. It felt weird initially to have to wait that long to know what happened on the Maginot, but I kind of ultimately ended up liking the way the show is paced based on where they placed this one. Again, I would like 2 or 3 more episodes, but that's just me.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you, only because In Space, No One feels like a sort of complete arc that then leads to the rest of the series. What I was looking for is like, the episodes where I was like, that was an entire thing and I liked it. So my runner up is the second episode, Mr. October, which is essentially just ship crashes into building, aliens loose. We got to get it out. So it comes as close to being an alien movie until we get the actual alien movie. I think there are some things like the last two episodes could increase better in my mind once I know how they conclude. So like once, you know, a season two decides a bunch of stuff that happened in the latter half of the season is important, I could see maybe something else going in second. But I think In Space No One is always going to be the best episode of this season, regardless of what happens in the future.
Hell yeah.
And we have more to learn about. Who killed Sullivan? Alien Earth season two, front of the t-shirt. Who killed Sullivan? Back of the t-shirt.
Yep. Give us another flashback episode.
Oh, it says who killed Sullivan, and then it's crossed out and it says what killed Sullivan. Yeah, there we go. Give me that crew t-shirt. Anyway, what was your most memorable line or moment from this season, Neil?
Well, I'm going with a moment that we sort of predicted on the pod the week in advance, but we thought it was going to come at the end of the penultimate episode, but it happens way earlier than we thought, which is Wendy, as she's exiting the lab, she's got some growing discontent with Boy Cavalier and Kirsch, and she turns and for the first time in the presence of anyone else makes the clicking noises. And the xenomorph responds by smashing its face against the glass, I think it's a turning point. It's a lore turning point for this entire franchise, right? Which is like, here we now have the first human-ish entity who can communicate with, or at least as far as she thinks, can communicate with xenomorph. But I would say the show gave us plenty of evidence, even though Wendy doesn't seem super sure that she's like using all the right words. The xenomorph does what she asks every time. So I feel like safe to say she can communicate with the xenomorph. And I think it's a really great moment. Like it's just cool, man.
Yeah. Mine was also Wendy clicks and the xenomorph does something, but it was when the xenomorph attacks the Yutani soldiers in the jungle. Because like then the xenomorph was free and it didn't have to follow them, but it did.
Sure.
And I was like, oh, shit. So that was the Rubicon cross for me. But my second one was protect the omelet. And then she jumps out of the ship.
That was pretty cool.
That's just what a way to end a two episode pilot. It's the guys, where the hell are we from Lost moment. And it was just amazing to me at the time, because I just assumed these children stuck in machine bodies would be scared of the xenomorph, and that was my fault. Wendy is not scared of the xenomorph at all. So that was just a nice little shot in the arm, and it's going to be one that I remember watching as season one was unfolding a little bit as we go forward, unless there are gigantic moments in season two. Cross my fingers. Neil, what was the best gift of the God of Death? So I think this is just the death that we appreciated the most. I'm going to let you decide on if we take it from like a technical standpoint or like a moral standpoint.
I mean, the way I usually approach this award that we do for every show was just like, who gets the most fun death?
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I'm giving mine to Michael Smiley, the actor, who is a veteran of the Cornetto trilogy, and I remember him from Spaced, but he plays Schmill, the engineer, the lead engineer on the Maginot, who is the first, I guess, we see the cat get the eye, but like he's the first person who interacts with the eye. And I actually think that's kind of a cool, fun way to go. Like if I were on the Maginot, let's say, and I knew that I was not going to make it back to Earth, right? Because obviously I'm not the head of security in this scenario. I think I would want to be killed by the eye, even though it seems very painful. Mm-hmm. There are no like painless deaths from any of these creatures. So at least with the eye, maybe I'm a little conscious as the eye is like inside of me. Maybe I'm a passenger as the eye is like calling the xenomorph to have like a duel. That's pretty fun. But I just, I mean, I love that for him. I very much enjoy Michael Smiley's presence in many things. And him being the guy who gets the eye in his face is pretty, pretty great. And you know, it kind of talks. I don't know if it,
yeah.
It, I don't know if I necessarily believe yet that it's going to be able to have full conversations in Arthur's body, but you know, it's a fun escalation for that little character, the eye.
No, I also enjoy the eye. He's on my list, but not at the top, because Ooh, okay. My best gift to the God of Death was the latter definition, because I still chuckle that the xenomorph slaughtered an entire party of dandies, of French style dandies, in that that building in Mr. October.
Yeah.
And he did it off screen, but we saw the result of it, and I think that's hilarious. If that doesn't count because it was off screen, then you don't have to go very far for my second choice, because it's right, it's how he gets into the dandies, which is there's a prodigy soldier that he holds by the head, inner mouths into the head, and then uses that mouth to throw him into Joe and other soldiers. And so they get out of the way, and then he runs into the party of dandies. That's probably the best on-screen kill that I saw this series.
I mean, the xenomorph, you know, we haven't talked a lot about the xenomorph. Neither one of us picked him for best visual effects, but the xenomorph looks great throughout this entire show. And get some gnarly kills, especially early on, especially in the Olympian xenomorph. The first one gets a lot of really cool kills. And then, you know, I mean, the one on the island gets some cool ones as well out in the fields and stuff. And again, I really enjoy the way the show worked around its budget and gave us different angles and put the xenomorph just out of focus while it's like splashing around in the background. a lot of fun xenomorph kills, and it did a good job of getting it out into the open, right? Like, that's kind of one of the underlying premises of this series, which is, now that we're not on a spaceship anymore, let's see what this thing does out in a field. And it lived up to how terrifying I would have hoped it would be.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. A great pet to have if you're human hybrid.
Again, this is why I want the Wendy package. I want to be able to talk to the xenomorph.
This category you've called in space, it's creepy as fuck, but this is the best jump scare of the season for you, Neil.
Mm-hmm. Well, this one from the finale, I believe. There's a couple of really good ones in the finale. Again, perpetrated by the xenomorph, who's very sneaky. Mm-hmm. But the one with Dame Sylvia, where she's just in the cemetery and it's just like shows up behind her, is great. And actually had me jumping in my chair the first time, where I was like, oh shit, there it is. And I think that's the one. My runner up, I think, hopefully this one wasn't on your list, is when Isaac is going into the fly's cage.
Oh, the bump with the bump, sheep head.
The sheep bumping the glass is just fantastic.
Yeah. I mean, that one made me actually jump.
Made Isaac jump too, to his doom.
That's true. My number one and my number two spots, one made me jump and the other one made me cheer. Made me jump is Miss Octo Leaps at Nibs from episode 2, where it just kind of comes out of the cat and then it's like, oh, a little octopus thing. And it's like, no, it defies gravity and just leaps directly at Nibs. I was like, oh, this thing's much like creepier.
Slingshots across the room.
Yeah, and then my second one that made me cheer is also from that episode, but the xenomorph is hiding in the statue when the prodigy soldiers are looking for it. We just see it in the background climb down out of the statue. I'm like, yes, xenomorph.
Now that is some xenomorph out in the wild shit. That's what I'm looking for here.
That's the classic 1979 alien that hides rather than running at you. That's the scary alien.
Mm-hmm.
We have here two more categories. This penultimate one is most in need of a Union Award season edition. Depending on whether or not we think robot synth union should be a thing, there may be limited choices for this, but who did you pick for this award?
Just as a rules aside, I do think that you could include the synths. I did not in my pick, because I think there's an even more obvious choice here, which is young Joe Hermit, who is under constant threat of bodily harm by his employer / government / patriarch, literally Boy Cavalier himself, like hand selecting this dude to lose his lung. Well, first he loses his sister to the corporation, yeah. which is rough. And then his dad dies. And then he seems to have a pretty uninteresting and then sort of frustrating life because of all of this, right? The corporation is like holding him captive on Earth. He doesn't know that it's also his sister doing it. But then things really escalate where the corporation asserts its dominance over his physical body several times, right? It's
yes.
it's his lung. It's like threatening to make him pay for his lung if he doesn't play along with this thing with his sister. And then all the way up to trying to implant the eye into him. Like, I don't know. This guy needs a union rep so bad.
I agree. Joe Homer was also at the top, but I did have a runner-up, which is Arthur Sylvia, because I am sort of unclear on what his legal stance with his wife would be should he have gotten off the island.
Yes. Like, can your employer terminate your job and your marriage in the same moment? Without cause.
Right. Yeah, because if he's just like, you'll be shot if you're seen on the island again. Also, your wife can't leave. That just sounds like the company is able to terminate his marriage.
Yeah.
I do agree he was slightly more aware of what he was doing, at least when it came to the hybrids. So definitely below Joe Hermit on this list. But also, I would say if you sign up to have like a hybrid program that's already dangerous, where like, worst case scenario, you murdered some kids and made a rogue AI, which is how Arthur categorizes it. They also shouldn't change your entire work environment to be a hazardous off-world species study group.
Sure.
That seems like too many things for one island. So yeah.
Listen, and
I'm sad Arthur couldn't get out of there.
It's a cautionary tale about working with your spouse as well. Compartmentalize your life a little bit there, Arthur.
Surely there's another corporation. No, I mean, that maybe we'll find out more. Dame Sylvia did survive, one of the three kept alive in the cell at the end of the season. Mm-hmm. So maybe we'll get some more background into the Sylvia family. Knows?
Maybe she'll structure. See Arthur again.
Best needle dropper closing song. This is the only one I had one entry for. So, Neil, ooh. Which one did you pick?
Well, I didn't choose a closing song. So if yours is a closing song, then you win.
Mine's a closing song.
Excellent. Mine is the Alt J needle drop in was that episode 6? Tessellate.
It's, yeah.
I feel like we tried to sort of like pick apart the individual lyrics and what they mean, but this one was not subtle, which I appreciated. Like this one is really like all about the triangles and about the coming together of Yutani and Boy Cavalier and this very feckless mediator who ended up not really doing a whole lot, but felt very proud of himself at the end of the meeting. But yeah, I think it was a good, it had a really good beat that sort of was good travel music for Boy K going to the meeting. And then the way that it sort of ends right as the meeting starts, I think is that's like perfect needle drop stuff.
Yeah. I love it. Mine is Stink Fist by Tool. Just
hell yeah.
Like that song. Again, as you could tell from my list, really like that Mr. October episode. Just not enough to put it above In Space No One in terms of best episode. Very, very close for me.
I'd say that episode's a close second for me as well. Like those first two episodes, really. It's like episode 5, those two, and then everything else is sort of lumped in underneath those.
We have some very important questions before we head to the storm. Will the other Lost Boy models be able to further their abilities beyond their programming? This is my sort of like question where we could speculate about if it's going to happen in season 2, but I am wondering just exactly how special Wendy is. We know she has some different hardware, but is the danger of this hybrid plan, are you actually like creating entire new sentience that is going to be able to grow beyond whatever you program them for? That seems interesting if it could happen outside of Wendy, because then maybe it's replicable and then maybe something was invented here. Otherwise, it's an anomaly, which is an interesting wrinkle as well, because then you really, really have to protect Wendy. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's the only thing that gets Boy Cavalier to care? I don't know.
I mean, it's a really interesting question, and it kind of goes with some of what I was thinking after my rewatch, which is, you know, why would Wendy have different hardware? Why would Boy Cavalier make her a little special? But I'm now kind of wondering, and my question is this all part of Boy Cavalier's plan for Wendy?
Yeah.
I'm kind of wondering if there's a dual purpose to this program, where it's like, maybe the Lost Boys were really just the floor models for the consumer edition of this technology that Boy Cavalier was going to sell for money to the people of Prodigy Land. But maybe he did something special with Wendy to achieve the other goal that he was going for, right? The desire to have an interesting fucking conversation with like one thing or entity, because there's just this element of like his smiles at the end when he's like imprisoned. He's kind of proud of Wendy. It seems like it's almost like he wanted this. He wanted Wendy to become fully actualized in some way, right? To not just figure out how to use her powers, but for her to succeed humanity in some way.
And what he did with his father.
I think it can be both. Like, I think Boy Cavalier is certainly an intelligent enough villain archetype to be able to have both of these things going on in his mind at the same time. Here's the other thing that I noticed on my rewatch that kind of fed into this. I actually forgot that it was Marcy as she's going into the transfer process, as they're laying her down on the bed, she's the one that chooses the name Wendy, right? She's like, she looks like a Wendy when she looks at her new body. And I was like, well, that's interesting, because that would mean potentially that Boy Cavalier took that as the jumping off point to create the whole Peter Pan narrative.
Was he also showing her Peter Pan on the ceiling when she's doing that?
Was he? Maybe
the Disney Peter Pan clip that we got.
Yeah. So maybe and even then, I still think it could all be sort of a piece of his manipulation, right?
Yes, definitely. That's not clearly outlawed in any of the things happening.
To sort of set Wendy apart from the other children, and to, again, have different intentions for what she will become. Whereas, like, you know, Nibs and Slightly and Smee are all just like they're the ones who would actually, in Boy Cavalier's mind, go and, you know, hang out with the investors and sell the product. Whereas I think Boy Cavalier is kind of looking at Wendy as maybe his successor, or if he can prove out the technology, maybe Boy Cavalier wants to make one for himself. We'll see.
Ooh, let's talk about that in our season two prediction sections in the storm, which is coming up right now.
I am the storm, brother. The first storm and the last.
I'm going to jump right in with my little season two prediction, which is we're going to pick up fairly close to where we leave off. But Wendy's going to think that she can use her captivity of Boy Cavalier to sort of control the Prodigy apparatus.
Sure.
She's going to recognize that he's the one that needs to be around in order for them to keep the company going and have like a smooth transition of power. So I think they're going to try to install him as like some sort of like puppet leader, obviously. But that's the whole like reversal of season two, where his hubris was, I could control the alien. Wendy and the Lost Boys hubris is going to be, I could control Boy Cavalier. And I think we could make him like a harder villain in terms of whatever is happening in season two than we were here. But the complication of that is we don't hear anything in the first Alien series about Prodigy existing at all.
Sure.
So I don't know how long Prodigy can exist as it is, or a Boy Cavalier on top of it, without necessarily messing with how we understand the universe works in the Alien franchise.
Yeah. I mean, you almost see the potential for a multi-season arc of this show being about how the Prodigy Corporation went away.
Mm-hmm.
But I do like, I like your idea of the reversal for Boy Cavalier, and for him creating sort of the challenge of a second season for his character being, how do I overcome the fact that I'm now no longer in control of Wendy? And, you know, maybe that leads to him having to do something that ultimately wrecks his larger plan, right? Because I think when we end, where we end this season, I think Boy Cavalier is kind of happy about what just happened. Like, he's proud that Wendy has sort of ascended to a new level, but that's the kind of decision that he may come to regret. And if there is sort of an arc, a longer arc for his character, he may end up having to like destroy that which he loves in order to,
right,
you know, save, you know, I guess, where's the line for Boy Cavalier? Is it just that, like, at what point would he do something to destroy the hybrids and basically like call it off? Right. I think it would be like, if they were, if it was a threat to the rest of humanity, potentially. But we'll see.
Maybe not.
Or maybe, I mean, if she just tried to leave with his intellectual property, like, he might just be like, I'm going to blow you up.
Yeah. He also, we don't necessarily know what makes Wendy a special model. So maybe she has less agency than she feels she does at the end of the first season. I don't know how long her, or how far her rewriting of code takes. It seems to be, it needs to be at least partially emotionally based to be super effective. So I don't think she's consciously rewriting her own code, which means maybe there's some sort of backdoor, maybe there's some sort of rule. We still don't necessarily know.
Yeah.
But my big question for just a big long view of season two is, can anything, including our Lost Boys, get off of Neverland Island without just breaking canon?
I think so. I honestly think that because of how little we really know about what's going on Earth, right? Like, what do we know about what's happening on Earth from the,
like,
alien
85 years from now, Ripley comes back and there's a space station around Earth that she doesn't leave, but it seems like Earth still has like a population. That's where like Burke comes from. But after, right, Aliens, we don't know anything about Earth, as far as I know.
Until Alien Resurrection, which is several hundred years later, right? And they come back and it's,
well, yeah, and the theatrical cut,
apocalyptic wasteland.
The theatrical cut doesn't include the apocalyptic wasteland shot, so that might not even be canon. Like, the theatrical movie ended while they were still in re-entry, and like with the promise of Earth. So like, we don't know that much about Earth.
So it's like, there's a hint that something goes wrong on Earth that ultimately ends in some sort of post-apocalyptic scenario. But even that's not necessarily canon. And then the other thing that we know is that the Weyland-Yutani Corporation is obsessed with acquiring a xenomorph, which doesn't, as we talked about in the column, doesn't preclude them from having xenomorphs. They might just want more, as far as we know. So I think even if like the scenario I described, like season two starts with Wendy parlaying with Yutani and being like, well, I'll give you the eggs if you just leave us alone, and Yutani being like, all right, fine, that to me doesn't break canon, right? Because I guess technically in canon, Yutani is collecting all kinds of weird shit, so including a predator gun, which we still haven't seen. But I do think that this show has not in any way, especially because most of this franchise takes place in like disparate corners of the universe, I don't know if they can break canon, right? Like, there's nothing, we don't get a ton of stuff about what's going on Earth. So who knows? Maybe there's an outbreak of ticks that kills off most of humanity.
Everyone's got to live on the ring.
Right. And again, the thing that Kirsch says about Wendy to Joe in, I think it's what, episode 7, where he's like, you know, we designed her to be able to create faster than light travel and travel the galaxy. I still think that kind of feels right as an end game for Wendy, whether she's got a xenomorph with her or not, or whether she's like alone, her leaving Earth and going off, even if she's going off to LV-426, to try and find more xenomorphs, still doesn't, in my mind, break any sort of canon, and then leaves Earth kind of alone. Like imagine a scenario where it does come to a conflict point between either Wendy and Boy K, or Prodigy and Weyland-Yutani, and Neverland Island is demolished. But Wendy escapes, gets in a spaceship, and flies off. That all still makes sense in canon for me.
All right. So let's see. When does Aliens the sequel take place? Well, oh, on the timeline.
You gotta look up the timeline.
That's the year 57 years after the events of the first movie. Mm-hmm. So 59 years after Alien Earth.
Okay.
Earth is still around and not taken over by Xenomorph. I think that would be the line that I would be like, probably that exists. Otherwise, why lie to Ripley and keep her up on that, you know, that space station if there wasn't like some sort of Earth thing? And I think the original four movies would like us to think that somewhere in between Alien 3 and Alien Resurrection, the Yutani Corporation's downfall was whatever happened to Earth. So Earth being sort of like whatever is also why we don't have the Yutani Corporation. We have the whatever science military we have in Alien Resurrection. I would think.
So it's about, it's like within the next 100 years.
Right.
We see the downfall of Weyland-Yutani.
I would treat those at least as interesting guardrails. I don't think those are restrictive to a lot of stuff. I do think nothing gets off the island is very restrictive, but that also means it's just going to be surprising when something does. But I would be on the lookout to like 100 years later, Wendy is the alien queen and Earth is the alien homeworld. I'd be like, that's a little bit too far.
Sure.
Because still by the time Aliens take place, the idea that the alien could get back to Earth is what motivates Ripley to just like, this can't happen. We got to nuke the whole planet from orbit.
Sure.
Which
is again why I feel like Wendy escaping with the Xenomorph away from Earth is a more likely scenario. Because that at least that keeps those guardrails in place.
I am having trouble seeing her trading off eggs because I think she would think of them as like part of the family. But sure. I would think that maybe if she's able to communicate with the Xenomorphs and it really is like a two-way thing, I've always appreciated the idea that the aliens are in search of a queen. They would know there's a queen out there. Mm-hmm. Maybe they need her to get them to the queen, and that's what gets Wendy off planet.
Sure.
Is trying to find, I don't know, the mom. I don't know how cute or not cute that would be.
Well,
not my problem, no Holly's problem.
You know, one of the important things that we know from the prequel movies is that the black goo is not a single planet thing. It is scattered across multiple planets, multiple moons at this point. So like the Xenomorph family tree does not only exist on LV-426, right? It David has ensured that it's spread all over the place. So,
and then you have stuff like the alien comic books where you have like warring hives of Xenomorphs. It's just like, we're two Xenomorphs from different backgrounds, but we're like, you know, black ants and red ants. And so we're just going to go at each other. So that's also a possibility that we're just on a Xenomorph side, not the Xenomorph side, which like I would see Wendy's Xenomorphs fight David's Xenomorphs somewhere in space. It seems like a very expensive TV show, but I'll do it. I guess that is a way of circling around. What are the odds we see a Yautja? Which is just, how interested is this series in crossing over with anything else? Because it has set up a lot. We both, like, our main criticism of the show is we would like more, please. So it doesn't need to necessarily do any of these things. It doesn't need to pull an alien Romulus and be like, here's another Ash model. But I guess on the level of Ash, David, Engineer, Yautja, how much does Alien 2 or Alien Earth Season 2 want to cross over with the other franchise?
Well, listen, this is probably the part of me that desperately wants to see Alien and Predator on the screen together in a way that feels good and not what we've gotten in the past. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it's exciting to live in a time where both sides of this franchise are thriving, right? There's good Predator stuff. There's good Alien stuff. Why can't we have a good Alien and Predator stuff? So I think that, but I do sort of now looking back at Alien Earth, the entirety of the season, understand what Noah Hawley is going for, which is like, let's establish our corner of the story world. Let's establish the fact that we can make a good Alien show. And then maybe we'll get a little lively in the second season when it comes to, you know, branching out and expanding the story world in significant ways. And maybe they're waiting to see how Predator Badlands does. Like, is will Dan Trachtenberg's Predator series continue to be good? If that's successful, though, right? And Dan Trachtenberg has said, as we talked about, I think, last week on the pod, there's a very good story reason why Weyland-Yutani is involved in the Predator movie. Then who knows? Maybe season two is where you start to bring these things together. And, you know, it's very expensive to also have a Yautja, I would imagine. So, but I don't, even though we didn't get any like direct hints in season one, I don't feel like that kills the potential for these two to intersect at some point. And I would personally enjoy that more than them bringing back other characters that we've seen, Ash, David, an engineer. Again, because I don't think this story is like the Prometheus and the prequel series were very much interested in how the xenomorphs and the goop were tied into the origins of humanity. And like, you know, the thing that we come from is the thing that will come and destroy us, sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
This show's not interested in that at all, which is this show is more about like, will the thing that we create use the thing that we come from to destroy us? Right. Will the hybrids be the thing that our hubris creates that ultimately kills off humanity and destroys Earth or whatever? So I don't think we necessarily need to have an engineer. But you know, I guess if they've got the budget for a Fassbender, why wouldn't you do a little David? You could have David come back, I guess.
The thing that I think would be interesting and sort of Noah Hawley-ish is like sort of what they did with like Legion season two, where there was a runner where John Hamm was just monologuing about like a toxic idea and how a toxic idea could become something else. And it was this little like goop chicken monster.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just like this sort of like runner that was going along with the rest of the show and ended in a very interesting way. But I would be very interested if there was just some Michael Fassbender voiceover about what it takes to, you know, create a life mm-hmm. that is going alongside whatever we're doing in like season two. And it doesn't need to connect at all.
Sure.
It just has to be like Wendy's internal monologue is also David's internal monologue now because sure. she's toying with the idea of becoming a villain. Or like I could see something like
Wendy
that.
Wendy gains access to Weyland-Yutani's systems and like starts watching David videos.
Yes.
Like David communiques. That would be kind of interesting. Yeah.
So that I think is probably the best version of this. Amanda Ripley's canonically 9 right now.
That's true.
That I think is the worst version of this because Amanda Ripley isn't supposed to know anything about xenomorphs for a while, is my understanding.
That's true. Yeah, and I feel like the story of Amanda Ripley, both with the Alien Isolation game and the, I think it was an animated series that they did based on it, sort of been fleshed out. Like, I don't know if we necessarily have more story to tell there. And again, the Predator thing, what I will be paying attention to when Predator Badlands comes out is if there's any indication of where it fits on the timeline, like what year is it taking place in? Because if it's taking place around the same time, that's going to send the antenna up for like potential crossover. But if it's like way out in the future, then it's just classic Alien Predator franchise things where like shit's happening all over the galaxy, you know?
Yeah. When do they start putting the logo on the back of the eyeballs? We'll find out this year in Predator Badlands. I don't necessarily think it needs it, but I wouldn't be surprised if Like, let's say they got a season two renewal, but season three looked like kind of soft about halfway through season two. Ending it with like a boot into the shared franchise, I think would be a fun way to like end it, to end your narrative, you know, showing the, I don't know if it's necessarily as small as showing the Predator gun on Yutani's wall, but it would be interesting to be like, and then the Predators were out there and then be like, if you guys want, if you, Disney, want a crazy season three that is Alien versus Predator, buy that because you're not interested in buying more Alien Earth. Mm-hmm. I could see that sort of being like a Hail Mary.
Again, Wendy gets off the planet with her xenomorph, or both of them. They go to a new planet. They land on the planet. They walk out onto the planet and realize it's a Predator planet.
It's a Predator planet. It's like,
oh, shit, here we go.
Yeah, that's that would be that with a heavy metal song over it would be the most 2005 ending to an action franchise ever. Mm-hmm. So I would recognize that. But overall, Alien Earth, I'm surprised with how much I'm content with it just being its own little weird show about consciousness and alien pets.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
And we'll, you know, we'll get Alien Romulus in the future. We'll get some Predator Badlands later this year. And hopefully by the time Predator Badlands comes along, we will know whether or not we're getting Alien Earth season two. And if so, Neil and I will.
At this point, right? Predator. Yeah. Oh, no, about a month and a half. I think it's the end of November.
Yes. So. And Noah Hawley said in the next couple of months, he was hoping for a renewal. And he said that in September. So we might be in the second of two possible months. Don't despair quite yet. But if it comes back, we'll let you know over on our other podcast, or this podcast, while we're talking about the HBO series Welcome to Derry and the Stephen King book It. If you want to scroll further back on this Storm of Spoilers feed, I think at one point we did a Stephen King off-season tour that was too quick for everybody. And I remember being like, man, we should do more in-depth Stephen King stuff. That's coming in 2 weeks. So next week, we're going to take a week off, reset ourselves, and we'll be back with more Storm of Spoilers, but in the fictional town of Derry, Maine, in October. So go out there, be excellent to each other. Oh, we all float down here. All things serve the beam. There we go. All things serve the beam.